Welcome to Extrovert Developer, a podcast about technology in New York City. I'm Ben Gunderson, and to my right is Jim Wallace.
Hey, everybody. I should probably say thank you, or
welcome
to all our new Reddit listeners.
Yes. Shout out to Reddit. You guys have been great. Our programming has been big fans of us so far, lots of upvotes, and lots of visitors according to our analytics. So thanks, guys. This is our first design-related podcast. And as such, our guest today is Megan Isaac, a graphic designer and art director in New York City, and a coworker of Jim and I's. Hi, Megan.
Hello.
Hey.
So, Megan, why don't you tell us a little about yourself?
Well, I am a graphic designer, obviously, and I'm from Idaho. I moved to New York City about 5 years ago, and I've been working in the industry mainly on the website. I do some print, and more recently, I've started working more on the mobile, doing more mobile with you guys at City Maps.
Awesome.
What kind of designer would you say you are?
Like, define, like, what kind of designer? Like, what is my specialty, like, my experience? Sorry.
No, you just said something that would be confusing to me, which is that you do a lot of the print stuff, but then you started talking about software, like you do mobile and you do web. And to me, those are different designers. Right. There's a print and media magazine layout type designer, and then there is a software designer. Do you think that there's a difference?
Interesting question. I think that in this day and age, it is hard to not have the knowledge and ability to be a designer without having web knowledge, because there's not enough work in the print industry anymore because of what is going on in the world is technology. There isn't as many print medium related jobs out there anymore. Like, if you want to solely do print, it's not possible. It's really hard to find a job.
Yeah, that being said, they are extremely different skill sets. I mean, the skills required to do print are different, but kind of the fundamental ideas of layout and balance and proportion all apply to both. And so I think that's the key ability being a graphic designer. But there are definitely people who specialize more in web, specialize more in print, like magazine designers and things like that.
I started in print, actually, because my background is photography. And I started laying out my first graphic design job was laying out a magazine.
Okay.
And then I started moving into web shortly thereafter. But my first real like wet work was actually laying out a magazine. And a lot of what you learn in laying out a magazine and spatial relation laying out something like a newspaper or a magazine really actually translates to web in the same way, because you're thinking about it in terms of, okay, well, what is the most important information? What do you want to know first, et cetera? So to me, that's actually, I think that it's good to have the print knowledge to a point so that you can use it on web. Yes, they are different skill sets, but I think that the knowledge is good to have.
What was the most challenging aspect of coming over from print to digital media to software, working with computer programmers?
No, that's not hard at all. I think that I'm a very like traditional when it comes to me. Like, my favorite thing in the world is to go to a dark room and like print photography. To me, like, that would be an ideal job.
That's right. Background is photography, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. So as a photography, like, as when I started my career, I was in the dark room, and then I slowly had to move to digital. And so for me, it was just like, okay, well, it's easier, but I miss the hands-on, the actual like touching things with my hands and having something that I can take out and actually hold. I miss that about printing something. And that's why I like print design, because of that.
All right. Used Photoshop from both the photo editing and also the web layout and, you know, slicing assets and things like that side.
Yeah.
Okay. So we discussed you moving to moving from print to web development and how you've dealt with web developers and kind of your learning process there. How do you feel you've grown as a designer from working in digital so much and working with programmers as opposed to working with an agency or working with designers all day?
I think that for me as a person, the skill set that you need to communicate with a developer is much different than the skill set you need to communicate with a printer. Because like with printing, the rules are very like set in stone. You have these colors, you have this medium, and this is how you print it.
Oh, sorry, you're breaking up, Megan.
And then there's this is how you get it to paper. When you're working with paper, there's so many layers to actually being able to actually accomplish something. So when you're designing for web, you're not only thinking in terms of how it's going to look, you have to think in terms of how it's going to interact with other things. You have to think about it in terms of how it's going to function. And not only on that, is it possible for it to function, and how is it going to work, and if it's the right move? There's a lot of different
things
that you have to think about. There's multiple layers to designing for web, as opposed to for print, it's just about communicating an idea and information. With web, there's different layers.
Is it easier because you can give them an Adobe Illustrator file and it comes out exactly like it looked on your screen? Whereas with the web, you actually have to code all of that into HTML and CSS. You can't just draw it and then have it appear.
Right. The difference between user experience with a flat medium as opposed to an interactive medium, there are some things, like we were saying, like with layout and proportion and readability, that do translate. But then there are the interactive parts of it that are, it's a huge difference designed for an interactive medium. What's been your experience moving toward more interaction, dealing with animation and linking between pages and, you know, Ajax controls and things like that? How have you adapted your skills to that?
Well, I think that it's more about just listening to people and listening to the developers and finding out information from them and asking questions to gather more details about what you're doing. The communication, I feel like, between developers and designers has to happen quite frequently, just because I think that I need to make sure what I'm designing is possible. I have to make sure that what I'm designing is reasonable also.
I agree. But, yeah, the design process definitely starts out on the design side. You know, you can't start to develop something until you have at least a template or a layout. But then it comes a loop. You start you start communicating back and forth and tossing ideas back and forth and slowly evolving the design to something that's closer to a finished product.
So I'm going to start even more fundamentally with asking you guys a question. As a computer programmer, I often think that the functionality of the site is the most important thing of all. Why does design matter?
Well, there's definitely, part of the difficulty between designers and developers is that level of communication. If you asked an artist why they did something a certain way, why they portrayed something a certain way, then that artist would say, because it's beautiful, because it moved me, because it made me feel a certain way. And you'll also often find artists and, you know, even business type people talking that way. Whereas a developer would, you know, as you're saying, talks about functionality, talks about performance, talks in much more, if not scientific, at least in very quantitative terms. And that communication is about learning to kind of bridge that gap, you know, both sides being able to kind of empathize.
Megan, any thoughts?
I think that for me, it's hard to explain because I've worked in jobs where design is more important than it used to be. Because I think it's as my job, like actually it's time, because design is more important today than it was like 5 years ago.
Why do you think that is?
Right now, well, I think that people are starting to realize that a beautiful design can actually change the person's perception of a product. Like if you have a beautiful design and something that's well designed, I think that I'm not just talking about the way that it looks. I'm also talking about the user experience, because if the user experience doesn't work, then the design is nothing.
Apple has certainly become the go-to example.
So that's what I'm thinking is, up until Apple, computer programmers were happy putting out Craigslist-looking websites that were functional and would make them $1 million. But Microsoft, in some ways, is not as aesthetically pleasing as Apple's design. They made billions of dollars with it, but now, today, Apple's iPhone division is worth more than all of Microsoft, the iPhone division.
Well, and a lot of the focus of Microsoft for a long time was on backward compatibility, on making sure that
Is a type of functionality.
Yeah, right. Every product worked on every version, no matter what. And it wasn't until fairly recently, probably 2004, 2005, that they started to move away from that, where, you know, the oldest DOS products just no longer worked or required some sort of emulation. Apple learned their lesson much earlier and made a clean break with OS X, for example. And
I'm not sure what that has to do with design, but yes, anyway, it's good.
No, but I think that it does, though, because, I mean, to a point, because Apple has put a lot of effort into their design, and their graphic designers are probably some of the best in the world.
Okay. When people hear design, software engineers think one thing, right? We think about the way our code is designed, but that's different from what you do, right?
Right.
You work much more with the visual design and making sure that user experience is correct. But don't you think that user experience is just becoming a buzzword?
Maybe. I mean, people care more about user experience than they did a long time ago, I guess.
I think user experience is suffering the same buzzwordiness as web design did 20 years ago, when people suddenly started calling themselves web designers because they knew Photoshop. And suddenly you know, web design, everyone was a web designer. Now all the people who called themselves web designers in the past are now user experience or user interaction designers. And they're all essentially saying the same thing, although I think a lot more is required of the modern web designer slash developer than was in the early days. Certainly your skill set must be a lot more broad. Now, you mentioned, we've talked about the difficulty of dealing with developers. I think as a developer, a big part of my day involves these back and forth conversations. I won't call them arguments because they're not always combative, but the difficulty of dealing with business people who may disagree on whether a design is good or whether a particular piece of functionality is needed or how important it is. How do you prove that a design is better? How do you prove that this button should be, you know, blue and not purple?
Well, actually, before you even get to that, I think that's a really great question. But back on our UX as a buzzword thing, I think everybody thinks that they're Steve Jobs, right? Which is the problem. That's the problem that arises. Just like you were saying that everybody used to call themselves a web designer and you were never quite sure what that meant. And like anybody could be a web designer because they knew Photoshop or someone was a real computer programmer. Nowadays, everybody thinks they know what UX is. Because that's they've played with an, or they've owned an iPhone, or they've played with an Apple product, and they're like, oh yeah, of course, this is UX.
Right.
And so they all think that they're as good of designers as Steve Jobs. And so I'm much more curious about how you handle that, including some computer programmers think this.
Right, how to deal with a mogul mentality.
Well, I think that it kind of relates to Ben's question as well, because...
I think they are, yeah.
Yeah, I think they're related, because, I mean, for me, the people who come to me and talk to me about user experience are people that are usually business people. Because they're like, well, what about this user experience? I mean, I really think this might work. And how do you sell that option?
Or how do you even make them realize like user experience or graphics design or something is a skill set that you've trained really hard for and that you really know what you're doing and that they need to trust you? Just like computer programmers, right? We've trained really hard and we know what we're doing.
And computer programmers can be as bad as the business end when it comes to talking to designers. They can be saying that, you know, the buttons should be on this side or the menus should drop down or, you know.
Right. And so usually in order to back up your argument, there's some sort of data or something like that. Or is there data for determining whether a layout is better or not?
Because it changes so frequently, design is kind of an art as well. Like beyond a website, the way a website looks, it's also art. And the way design, like the trends in design change frequently. Like they're not something that's like set. So one year, like this design is the best, but the next year this is the best. And it kind of goes through like kind of like an almost an art rotation, I think, as well as anything else in the art.
Certainly there are fads and
sort of like
and everything
fashion.
Like fashion. Like even when you yourself are having trouble deciding whether to go left or right with a particular design, how would you go about convincing yourself one way or the other if you say, well, I think these things look equally good to me, but they're clearly different. One of them must be better. Is that something that you even consider, or do you just choose a path?
I mean, in general, I usually go, because I probably, I'm trying to think how I would explain that, because it isn't about an individual item. It's about the overall big picture. Because when I design something, I'm not designing like the button, I'm designing like the big picture. And so if the button doesn't work with the big picture, I'm not going to I'm going to change it. So I could make a decision about a button or the button style 2 days ago, but then I actually am looking at, and I start designing something else, it doesn't work with something else. That's when I usually end up, I can make a change. Like I could change my mind because the big picture doesn't work together as a whole.
I see.
And a lot of times it has to do with what goes into the site, because I may decide what it looks like, but I don't dictate content. So if my content doesn't work with my design, I have to make sure that I have the right I have to modify my design for that content.
At what point in your process do you start pulling in other people and not just your coworkers, but say, when do you start doing surveys? When do you start doing focus groups and getting more qualitative or quantitative research on a design? When in your process do you feel that should happen?
I think it should happen. I think that after I've made all my final decisions, but maybe before, I don't know, because it doesn't always happen as it should. Like things don't always happen as it should. Sometimes I don't get to make those kinds of decisions, but I think it should happen. I think there should be a conversation outside of my group of people before the developer gets it. Because I'd love to have feedback and make some changes before the developer even has to do it. Because, you know, what if it takes too much time or whatever, but it's just an extra step in the process.
But too much feedback, I think, can hurt the design process, whether it's in software or in graphics design. There's this notion of design by committee. And this was really bad at Microsoft, right? Which is
really bad everywhere.
It is. So you've experienced this as well.
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
Every job I've ever had, it's always been, I've never had a job where it was just cut and dry. there's always been like 5 or 6 or 7 people whose, you know, ears I had to bend, like find out before I actually, before it was final.
Right. But you can also, you can damn design by committee, but there's also legitimate feedback that comes in from people who are actually, you know, who have a stake in making the product better. When does that kind of good feedback turn into design by committee? What's the line where you say, okay, now this is no one's, now no one is responsible for this design and everyone's just throwing at the wall to see if it sticks. When does it become bad? This is something I definitely don't have an answer to. And I think this goes for, you know, almost any kind of product, but there's certainly, you know, we've all experienced design by committee, products, features by committee. At one point, there's a point at which someone has to say no.
Do you have any interesting design by committee failures?
Complete failures. I have so many complete failures. Only because it's one of those things where you get to a point where you're like, I don't even care anymore. Because you've lost all interest in designing what you're designing. Because so many people have decided that they hate it or they love it or they want to change this or they want to change that. And it's gone through so many rounds of changes that your investment in a product is no longer there.
Yeah, right. That's the great danger of design by committee, is that you're diluting everyone's stake to the point where the people who really care about it, sometimes they no longer feel they have. They're like, well, it's not. I mean,
well, the real danger of design by committee is that it's just not good. It's not great anymore. Right. Maybe it's only good, right? It's merely a good design. It's not a great design. That's the real problem.
My best designs come when there's two people. When
it's two best.
People, yeah, my best work has come out of a two person like team.
You know, I think there's something really to that, because like a writer and an editor as a team of people, like I think that creates pretty good books where one person wrong voice, but then somebody comes in and just like tweaks the language, edits it. John Carmack has even mentioned that he thinks the best model for your programmers is the surgeon nurse model, where there is one person who's like the master, and then he can farm out individual tasks to sort of like a worker thread, like who works under him.
Even the extreme programming style is essentially that, right? It's two programmers working hand in hand, kind of looking over each other's
shoulders. The idea is one person has the vision all in his head, and he knows how to dole out into tasks that. Now, I don't know if John Carmack's opinion, and I think I work better in two, exactly two.
Right, because in my previous job, I was on a team of two. We worked really well together, first of all, so that helps because we communicated very well. But it was also some of the most excellent, we've designed some of the most excellent work I've ever done in my career, because the two of us just fed off of each other. And when we came up with the concept, we stuck with it. We didn't like budge on it. We didn't cave. We were like, all right, this is the concept, and we fought for it. And then when it was produced, we were proud of it.
Jim used the word vision, which I think is one of the most important words in what we're talking about, because that is what gets diluted in design by committee. You don't no one has a vision of the product. And you know, there's also a danger of the designer thinking they're Steve Jobs, the mogul designer who, you know, it's their way or the highway. But I think that's where the second person comes in. They're the voice of reason in some cases, and they're the editor.
Right.
Yeah, I like that.
Sorry, and Max. I think that helps with a developer hand in hand, because as long as I don't ever talk to the developer, I don't feel like I can finish my product. Because if I don't know for sure that this is possible, if I don't know for sure that, you know, like this is going to function properly, or even that being said, moving to the business person, you know, I also don't want to like stick the developer with so much work that they cannot finish it in a timely manner either. I like to be reasonable.
At your last company, or I'm not sure how to phrase this question, I'm wondering if you have an ideal way that you, like an ideal process of doing iterative design with the developer?
Not particularly. I like a process. I like there to be a process, as long as there's something in place, like where I'm like, okay, this is what I need to do. This is what you need to do. Like, as long as there's some sort of like schedule or just some sort of process or.
But you've never had one process that worked really well and then one process terrible and just didn't work at all?
Well, the process is that's terrible is when you don't stick to the process that you have.
Okay.
It's like when you don't.
Because I've definitely had processes that one stuck to were terrible.
Yeah, but I've also had it where like I mean I like it when there's a process and you stick to it and you don't like waver. Like for me, like as long as you design your work within a timely fashion and you give yourself wiggle room, I feel I'm comfortable.
But one doesn't produce better results than the other.
Well, I think part of what she's trying to say is that even more so than a particular process, communication is the the thing that a designer, you know, needs most from everyone.
So how do you tighten up that communication loop. So by communication, I assume you mean feedback, right? I've done this thing. Right, yes. But it doesn't work. Feedback, does it not work?
Expectations. Okay. What all goes into the designs? I mean, you know, what the developer is capable of doing and what they're not. What the business has, for example, has the money for and what they don't. How much time everything is going to take. When you know, all those things require constant communication. The designer talks to every level of the business.
This is exactly the same in computer programming, and so I'm really great to hear that other people have these issues. We constantly struggle with what is the right amount of process. Don't want to be overburdened with by any particular process. Mm-hmm. And yet we also want to try and minimize this feedback loop so that our designs, our software designs, are being tested and hammered on and not changing all the time, but they're still remaining agile, and we have lots of all the same constraints that you have. And yeah.
And certainly some process is better than no process, but I agree with Jim. There's definitely, I don't necessarily know the answer to what the worst processes might be, or I don't think I have any good stories.
I can tell you, I'm not a fan of filling out time cards. That's okay, like part of a enough. Process.
Definitely not a fan of that, right?
No, my biggest thing is, as long as I can work, I can set up my work environment where I work well. Like I have like the atmosphere around me where I'm sitting down and I'm working and I'm able to do, because the graphic design is an art, the process that's important to me isn't the process of how it gets to the developer. It's the process of me working. So if I can't work in my environment, then I'm screwed.
In the last 5 years, has there been a better work environment for you and a worse work environment? I'm trying to like ease out what's a good work situation, what's a good work process for designers.
It's about the people that you're surrounded by. It isn't just about like the location of your office.
Oh, that's all that matters. Union Square.
Well, you know. No, for me, it's great. Like, for example, at a current job, we're in a room with 7 people right now.
We were.
We were in a room with a very, very small room. But when I first started there, it was great because there was only 4 of us. But now, like, as they slowly added more people, it got harder and harder and harder for me to work. And it wasn't because of talking, and it wasn't because of this, because I could put headphones on. I think it's an energy in the room. And I know that sounds funny, but for me, I think it was just energy in the room.
I certainly think that someday in the future we will tell the horror story we will tell is of the 7 people in a room and how difficult that could be sometimes with crosstalk and distractions and not being able to kind of find.
Yeah, there's a great debate in computer programming right now about whether developers should have their own individual offices, close the door, right, and have quiet time in order to be productive, mm-hmm, or whether or not they should have an open floor plan so that they can collaborate with the designers and collaborate with the business. Having an open floor plan is supposed to ease these communication channels. After the 7 people in a room, I am on the closed office camp. I really am. I'm with Spolsky and Microsoft on that.
I worked in an environment like my last job. We were in the collective, like in a place where you can actually, like, there's multiple offices there. And there's clear wall space between each of the offices. I don't know those people, but there's only 2 people in my little office. But the energy I got from the other people was enough for me to work. And I think if I was working by myself, even in where I was surrounded by a clear wall and I could see the other people, I would be fine. But I could not sit, like, for example, in my apartment where I'm by myself all the time and I can't see other people. I could not do that day in, day out, day in, day out.
That's fair. So yeah, I was a freelancer for 3-4 years and did not enjoy the feeling of cabin fever. I definitely, I would have to get out and go to a coffee shop, find somewhere with just like some human energy around me in order to kind of remain focused. Sometimes we talked about this on the last podcast a little bit with, Jim's definitely in he can sit by himself and, you know, enjoys working from home. And I enjoy it to an extent, but,
I don't know. There's enough people outside my window, New York City.
That's true. There's people. You're never alone in New York City.
Well, even on the weekends, like if I'm going to work for a couple hours, I'd rather go to the coffee shop than work at my house.
Really? Everybody has that idea. And then the coffee shop is super crowded. The Wi-Fi is terrible.
Right.
They want you to leave.
This is why you should get Jim's Google map of...
Oh, where can I code?
Where can I code?
It could be easily where can I work.
Could be where can I write? Where can I focus?
Right.
Yeah, it's a collaborative wiki map that we created on Google Maps before I joined City Maps, City Maps platform. I hope to bring it there. That it's just a list of places around the city. People add to it all the time. They let you know information about, like, hey, it's crowded on Sunday. Like, don't go.
Yeah. Also, working in a library is good, too.
New York Public Library, man. Good. I just got my library card.
Is there Wi-Fi at the library?
Boom. There is apparently Wi-Fi at the library. Huh.
I could easily work in a library.
So one other question I had was, So Megan, without trying to date you here, how you've been in the design, you know, in the business of web design for several years now, and kind of watched the web reach, you know, go from a pretty nascent state design wise to where it is now, where design is flourishing. How do you feel the job market has changed, you know, over the last 5-6 years, especially in New York City? You've been in New York City more than twice as long as either of us, and you know, worked for several companies during that time. How do you feel the job market?
Well, I mean, it took me about 6 months to find my first job, and I got laid off last November, and I started working at City Maps within 2 weeks. So I guess that kind of says a little bit about it. I mean, but though I was also entering the job market when I first came, the fact that it did not take me very long to find a job, and I saw people all over me struggling to find jobs when they got laid off, it made me feel good about the industry that I was in, for sure. I think it also comes with a certain skill set. I mean, I think in order for me to find a job, if I didn't have the skill set that I had, I don't think it would have been as easy.
We've discussed, Jim and I have discussed the job market for developers and how much power developers are starting to really have. Hopefully, the unprecedented demand that, especially in New York, we're starting to see for good developers. Do you feel that's the same as going for web designers? Is it, are you becoming more powerful in the industry?
I think we are, because I think that people are starting to recognize that what we do is so important. Because 5 years ago, or even 10, I mean, maybe 10 years ago, it wasn't as important to design your website. Websites looked horrible 10 years ago. You remember what websites looked like?
Yeah, I was reading an article on Forbes recently where they essentially said that every company is starting to become a software company, especially large companies. Everyone is now in the software business. Also, you know, as we've said more and more, that means that information architects and interaction designers as well, that has created this immense job market for developers. Do you think the same goes for designers, and how should designers best take advantage of this hugely beneficial force?
Well, it's true. Every company is, you're right, exactly. It's extremely true that every company is becoming a software company, because everyone needs an iPhone app. And everyone needs an iPad app, and everyone needs an Android app. And beyond that, you also need a website. So I think you're right about that for sure. It's hard to do those things without a designer. And people quickly realize that you have to have a designer in order to accomplish those goals. The second part.
We've outsourced basically all the manufacturing, but we've also outsourced most of the IT help desk stuff as well. And now the design and development market is still, I guess, is taking over.
Well, and if you think about it, think about how hard it is to collaborate with somebody who is overseas. We had a hard time at City Maps with our developers that were overseas. I mean, in other companies I've had, it was hard to work with someone who was not on site. So I think that there's also kind of a shift in the fact that people are starting to recognize it's easier to hire somebody locally than it is to hire somebody over the globe. I mean, I think I would prefer to work with somebody next to me. I do not like working with somebody I can't talk to.
Do you think that means working with someone via Skype, for example, or just not working by email?
Just not working by email. I think Skype might be okay. I haven't had to work a lot with someone via Skype, but I also like having a personal relationship with the people I work for, because it makes it easier.
That's
talk
true.
To people. This is crazy talk.
I like to enjoy working, and I like to become friends with my coworkers. And I mean, I just in general think that it's easier to work with somebody when you're right next to them, to just be like, oh, here, give me this, or for them to ask you something instead of I am you.
I want to come back to this thing about how to bring objectivity into design.
With where we're at right now, because we're at a startup, it's hard to have that for the moment. So I just go off my experience. I just go back. I base my decisions on, well, this has worked for me in the past in other circumstances. I have been able, this has been a good decision in the past. So I'm going to keep with what I know. May not be right all the time, but it's a better bet than I'm just going to guess.
I agree that experience is really important, but I think what Ben is getting at is something like A/B testing, where you can literally show two different versions of the website to every other user who comes, and then see what they click on and see what happens. And that's one way to gather data and sort of prove objectively that this design is better. Like having a big red button here that they can click on is better because more people click on it than they would the little purple button, right?
Right, and A/B testing is that quantitative research we were talking about, just like a large, just like taking a large survey of, you know, a large multiple choice survey that all your users take. Or you get 10,000 people to, or, you know, you'd probably need a lot more than that. But
well, it's better than the survey because you're not asking them their opinion. You're seeing what they do, what they actually do.
True.
Right? Their behavior doesn't lie. They'll lie on a survey and say they love your product when they hate it.
Right. Well, you can also ask them more, you know, slightly easier questions, or at least more questions designed to actually get them to be honest. Like, you know, which of these, you know, which of these features was your favorite? Which of these features did you use and not use? And try to at least give them options that don't involve them trying to, especially
save your
if
feelings.
Your friends or family. Yeah, trying to save your feelings. I think a focus group, like a limited focus group, is better, where you can actually, you know, track people's eye movements and actually talk to them in depth and have them write out in much more detail how the product made them feel. But, you know, that's the qualitative end of the research.
No, I think I agree. I think it's great to do focus groups and stuff like that. I'm thinking about this because I feel like for me, this is more of like somebody else's job kind of thing. And it's hard to bring it into to me where I work at a startup now. I have to actually think about it and actually make that decision instead of, because in most circumstances, a marketing person comes to you and says, this is the data.
So they're usually another team is the one who's doing the research.
Yeah, this is not usually what I do, because at the last company, we had a online marketing client. So we designed for somebody who did online marketing. So they had hard data for us as far as this button is the best. This is this. And it's horrible aesthetically pleasing, but the data that they gathered from their A/B testing was fantastic. So they knew what buttons to choose. So those decisions sometimes were made for me. So I've worked where I've had hard data and I was told. But I mean, for me right now, I have a hard time because I don't have somebody telling me. What I'm trying to say was, I don't know.
I think in general, we need more scientific thinking, not just at Citymaps. We definitely need it at Citymaps, but we need more scientific thinking in our world.
Absolutely.
Decisions and things are based on data. But what I heard you just say was really interesting, which was that the design looked terrible, but it was provably better.
Right.
And I don't know how to reconcile those two.
Well,
It was sales driven though. So, you know, like what is the end goal? Like, what is your end goal? So the end goal was to get somebody to buy something. So when you're trying to get somebody to buy something, you make different decisions as you are if you want them to find out information.
Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah.
So you know, a big red button is more powerful, or orange. No, red was a bad button. It was like orange is the better button because orange was like red had some sort of like negative response or something like that. Orange was a better button.
Right.
It's like that.
And as a designer, you also have to be able to let go of your feelings, let go of what you thought was right. And, you know, as we say, you know, kill your darlings, you know, and in face of the scientific data. You know, if you have a ton of data that marketing comes and hands you and says, look, you know, everyone clicks on the ugly button, I'm sorry. And then you kind of have to, you know, internalize it and say, okay, right. what about the ugly button made them choose it?
Right.
And that can be difficult, you know, for your ego at times.
Exactly. And for me at my last job, I had to, you know, like swallow my pride and do stuff I didn't appreciate sometimes because that was the data. But at the same time, it's like I knew that I was making some, like the money was coming in because of it. So you can't really complain because you're designing something that's going to bring the company money. So in all reality, like you have to think about the end goal. What's the end goal? If you don't care about, like selling something, or if you don't care about actually like making money, then I guess you can do whatever you want.
Because your design was provably better for selling stuff, did you get any of that commission? Did you get any of that sales commission?
No.
Yeah, didn't think so.
It's not
ridiculous. You had a provably better way of getting sales. And if you were a salesperson calling on the phone and had a provably better way of talking on the phone, you would have gotten more of that commission. But because you created a design that was provably better, they're like, oh, okay.
And I think how to calculate what that commission is, or, you know, what part of the increase in sales you were responsible for is less important than actually just changing the culture to where we realize that designers and developers have a right to the profits, just as, you know, just as much as a salesperson does.
Right.
Or a business
and
person does.
At CityMaps, I want our clients to use our, like, I want people to come to our map and use our map because I'm personally attached to it. So I want the data to know, like, why, you know, what works better, what things people are going to use, what things people aren't going to use, because I would feel good about putting that in to my work.
Yeah, science needs to be a priority.
Exactly. I agree. I would take that under like huge consideration when I would design if I had that kind of data, or if I was able to put together some sort of focus group, I would pay close attention because it's important to me. Okay. Well, my pro tip is not to have a generic password because you will get malware on your nonprofit site if you do not.
That is a great pro tip.
Yes.
And oh wait, I'm going to start making my passwords in HTML colors.
Okay.
No. Oh, nice.
Because there are six letters, and they have numbers and letters.
Good way to think about it.
So the way I'm going to remember my color is I'm going to get like I'm going to write down the Pantone of it, and then I have to look up the HTML if I want to remember it. So I
might be able to help you with a better system than that, but that's clever. I like it.
No, so yeah, so my new password is some sort of Pantone, which I'm not going to tell you, so you can't look it up. But I'm almost. Yeah, so good passwords are important because...
And it's a good pro tip. You'd be surprised by the pros who have shitty passwords.
Right.
Yeah,
a hacker does not empathize with nonprofits. They will install malware even if you're trying to help poor kids in Nepal.
They don't even know that that's what has happened. It's all scripts that just run on computers. They just see a computer. They don't even know that it's a not-for-profit.
See, I wouldn't know that.
Like, oh, this version of WordPress has a security...
Yeah, they just know that you're running this version of WordPress.
Lets them know.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, it takes forever for it to get fixed, too. I'm on day five.
Yeah, let me tell you, they did not attack you. They didn't, like, go to your website and go, oh, let me attack this not-for-profit. This was completely automated. Like, there were no people involved in this hack.
Yeah. You computer programmers need to watch yourselves.
I do all the time. I love watching myself. It's my favorite thing.
Well, no, I'm just saying, like, in reality, like, this could be a different topic, but what makes a person do that to write the script? What makes a person? That should be a topic at some point.
I love that topic. That's a great idea.
They're actually paid very well in some cases.
To talk about hacking, black hat hackers, usually I think that computer programmers have a strong sense of right and wrong, just like truth, like binary, one and zero, something is true or something is false. And we don't like when we are lied to, like when Elliot says, oh, you guys all got chairs like that. And he's pointing to an Aeron chair. And then we get to the office and we realize we've got some generic knockoff.
We got generic knockoffs. True.
Yeah, we don't have Aeron chairs. We have crappy knockoff chairs. He lied. Well, but in his mind, he didn't, right? What he meant was we got mesh chairs.
Right, because he thought that was the secret sauce of why it cost $700. Oh.
Yeah. He thought that was the essential element, and it's not. And that's a really good topic about why they are able to be morally gray like that, because I'm not. I couldn't. And yet, at one point, I was sort of a computer hacker. Right. I broke into computer systems.
Well, I think the other thing that drives hackers is also just the desire, the curiosity, the desire to know how something works, wanting to take something apart to see if something is possible. But that's different from black hat hacking, which is much more focused on destroying something or profiting from the weaknesses of other people's IT knowledge.
Right, and right now, I have to not only deal with my hosting company, I have to deal with Google, and I have to deal with, like, it's ridiculous. Like, the malware is uninstalled, but I'm still getting the error message until, like, Google says they don't want it there anymore.
Yeah, I know.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, now with SEO and everything and Google automatically censoring malware sites.
Right. Well, I so actually
more long-term effects.
But I found out that we're not connected to Google Webmaster Tools, and if I connect this to Google Webmaster Tools and then I run a robot through it, it should be fixed. Because the data says we've only ever had malware come up once. So as long as I like run a robot again, it should be fine.
Google Webmaster Tools. That's a good pro tip.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love Google Webmaster Tools. Because you can actually you can actually like specify when you want the robot to, how many times like a page. Like you can say, okay, these level pages are going to run through, like on WordPress, because I use WordPress a lot. I can say these pages are going to be, I want them to be looked at once a week. I want these ones to be looked at daily because they're blog items. I want this to be looked at because they're archived items once a year, et cetera, et cetera. So I can actually, but I can go in the Webmaster Tools and tell them I want this to be looked at all at once right now so that the robot can see that I don't have malware anymore.
That is actually a great pro tip. I didn't know any of that.
And I don't know if this is all like correct or this is just my this is just my perception of how it works. My perception could be totally wrong.
That's fine. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, Google Webmaster Tools does have a method of, you know, proving that one person owns a site, linking like a real world person to.
Yeah, I set it up for our domain. I just haven't used it at all.
Great. Oh, I love it, and it's great because it's yeah, I use it for every site that I do. But I didn't know that my Kids Cam and didn't have it, so I am gonna set that up, and then it should hopefully take away my malware problem.
All right, Megan, enjoy dinner.
Yeah, I'll see you guys later.
All right. Bye. All right, so my pro tip is about Google Docs. I know this seems like kind of a funny pro tip to be having so late in the game, but when I worked at Microsoft, I didn't understand the point of Google Docs. I was like, it's a worse version of Word. Why would anybody use this? But recently, Jen, who was on the second podcast, and I got it in me that I could write a story, like a novel, because the more I'm in computer programming, the more I realize that programming is a lot like writing. And I was always a really terrible writer. But I was writing this novel out, and she was in there with me, editing my mistakes, like right behind me.
And adding in those little post-it comments.
Adding commas. I'm like terrible with commas. I don't understand how they work at all in grammar and syntax. And I would say something, and I could see immediately that she did not know what I meant by what I said. And I was able to add a comment and say, this is what I'm trying to say. And she would make it say that. And it was all live, interactive, in real time. And for the first time, I got Google Docs. I was like, I get it now. We were collaborating over the internet. We weren't there. You could have Skype up, and it as if you were both looking at the same screen.
And that's what they tried to do with Google Wave for like business documentation and chat. And kind of like I've used, Campfire as products that let you do that. This interactive documentation type thing. But yeah, I think Google Docs has it figured out for sure.
How about you, Ben?
Yeah, I want to come, in a future podcast, I definitely want to go back into writing as a part of interaction design, how copywriting is actually a huge part of telling people what your design is about. Yeah, my tip is actually, I'm kind of cheating this week. My tip is a product that's not actually out yet, but one that I've become really excited about recently. It's a little company called Pentotype, Pentotype, Pentotype. It's a wireframing tool that turns sketches into little interactive wireframes. You can either start with a pen on paper and scan it and upload it to Pentotype, or you can draw on a tablet or something, and it'll recognize interface elements. So you draw like a box that represents the your mobile website, and then you draw a little header box, and it actually will separate that out to where now you can drag that around, and you can draw the little buttons and write on the buttons, and it'll recognize a button or that's a region. You can split your diagram into regions, and then even better, you can start drawing, like we do when we're building wireframes. You can draw an arrow from a button to the next screen, the screen that button would lead to, and it will create, once you're finished linking everything together, it'll actually create a little interactive, like almost like a diorama for you that you can click through. You can click from one screen to the next using the buttons that you wired up, just using these little arrows and drawing buttons. The demo for it is really impressive. I signed up for it because I'm really excited to use this. I've used other wireframing tools before and not really been all that impressed. Or it was harder to use or to learn wireframing tools as it would to just draw it out in Photoshop, which always seems like a giant waste of time to me. So I'd love something that lets me, because I love to sketch my designs. I'd love to have a tool that lets me actually convert those sketches into some kind of skeletal mock-up rather than just having to draw it out in Photoshop. And I don't know, it's been a mess before, but I'm really excited about this one. So that's my tip.
All right, cool. All right, we're out.